Welcome to Power Play. Happy Easter Monday. I'm Evan Solomon. On a program today, schools shutting down.
The hospitals were reporting that they're doubling the amount of patients. They have doubled in the past 2 weeks. We know that ICU has got a maximum capacity. They are still transferring patients out of the hospital and have the maximum number of COVID patients they have ever seen.
It's getting bad. ICUs are filling up across the country. Case counts are climbing. The spread of the dangerous COVID-19 variants forcing some cities to shut down some schools. Why such short notice on this? Are the current restrictions enough? Should educators and teachers be getting vaccines as a priority? We'll talk to the woman you just saw, Mississauga Mayor Bonnie Crombie, where schools are just closed. And Calgary Mayor Nad Nenshi will join us, where today there are more calls for more restrictions. Then, who should get the shot? Is it time to prioritize essential workers? We've got a panel with Unifor Union Head Jerry Dias and Dr. Amit Arya, plus mass rapid testing in the UK. A lesson for Canada? Check this out.
I think that lateral flow testing will be of great advantage to us all.
Two rapid tests per week, one for everyone. That's the UK plan for safe reopening. Will Canada adopt the same process eventually? CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdushar Kawi joins us on that and lots more. That's on the press gallery. Plus, Derek Chauvin on trial, the Minneapolis police chief, condemns Chauvin's actions as not part of police training. This was pretty extraordinary. Look at this.
In no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
So where does that leave the case against the officer charged with killing George Floyd? We'll bring you the latest from that trial as well. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So the sudden surge in variant-driven COVID cases has suddenly forced a major region of the country to shut down its in-school learning. Schools in Ontario's hard-hit Peel region will make the switch to online learning. This comes days after a province-wide shutdown in Ontario came into effect. Remember, BC's in a circuit breaker. Alberta's got new restrictions. Quebec's got curfews and restrictions. Also today, a number of chief public health officers in Toronto, in Ottawa, and in the Peel region sent a letter to Ontario's chief medical officer asking for a provincial-wide stay-at-home order. In other words, more harsh measures. Are those needed across the country? Look, Alberta has reported 600 new cases of COVID-19 of the mutation yesterday. So are Canada's cities getting the help they need or the restrictions they require? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Mississauga Mayor, Bonnie Crombie. That's the key Peel region we just spoke about. Also joining us is the Calgary Mayor, Nad Nenshi. Tough times in both your cities, Mayors. I appreciate you talking to us, Mayor Crombie. I'll just start with you. Sure. We're just coming off the news here that schools in the Peel region and your region are switching back to remote learning. Just your reaction to this and calls for even wider restrictions.
So, listen, we were taken a little bit by surprise today at lunch hour when we had an emergency call with Dr. Lowe, and he decided to pull that emergency break and ask schools to close and children to learn remotely online. And really, it is those conditions that have continued to worsen that you described at the top of the show. Friday, he thought, give it a few more days. Maybe we won't have to close the schools. But what we're seeing is our numbers are at the same high levels that they were during the peak. We're seeing in Peel region 500 cases per day. And largely, as you said, are the new variants. We're seeing 15 to 20 people enter the hospitals each and every single day, that the hospital numbers doubled in the past 10 days. Our case counts go up 20% per week. Hospitals are at capacity. I have 83 people COVID positive in the hospital, 21 in ICU. That's over 40 in the region of Peel. So things have changed dramatically. We are still transferring patients out of the hospitals to other regions such as Niagara, Kingston, Ottawa, who have been taking our patients. So something had to be done. Things aren't working the way they've been working. And as you said yourself, here in Peel Regency and in Toronto, we have been in lockdown longer than any other region than in North America. So we have to do something different. And I'm going to leave you when I leave you shortly and get on a call with Dr. Lowe. And I will be advocating to do things differently. You know, whether we're expanding the list of non-essentials, whether we're putting up the vaccines, as you were suggesting earlier, we need to take a look at how we're doing things because it's not working. Case numbers are increasing and not declining. We don't have control of this virus. It has control of us.
Wow, that is a bleak picture. Okay, hang on, Mayor Crombie. I want to go to Calgary. Mayor Nenshi, you're listening to that. It's like we're in a new pandemic, right? As Bonnie Crombie said, things are switching like on a dime. We may need to recalibrate the strategy in terms of essential workers, vaccinations, teachers. Give us a sense of what's going on in Calgary and what's happening and what you want to see.
So very much all of that. You know, Calgary is roughly the same size as Peel Region, a little bit bigger. And we're seeing the numbers do something very, very similar to what we're hearing in Peel Region. Our hospitalizations are up. Our ICU admissions are up. We're not anywhere near the peak that we were in late November, but the acceleration and the exponential growth is extremely troubling. And, you know, I agree very much with Mayor Crombie in terms of the sorts of things she's saying, that we need a new kind of approach. The difference now, right now, is that we're doing this in the context of a lot of COVID fatigue. And so one of the key messages that I have for people is don't wait for government to put in restrictions. The future of the pandemic is in our own hands and it's in our own actions. And every one of us needs to make sure that we are acting as though we're in the most dangerous phase of the pandemic because we're in the most dangerous phase of the pandemic. Right. And while there's not just light at the end of the tunnel, while the tunnel is sort of filled with light, we got to finish strong. We got to be disciplined. We've got to maintain that discipline. And as awful as it is to say this, you don't want me to be the soldier who's killed on the last day of the war. You want to make sure that we're finishing strong and quickly, and we've got to keep these restrictions in place. So, for example, you know, we're going to hear from our public health officer probably tomorrow, and we'll see if she has anything more to say then. But for example, we've seen the schools close in certain places, and we know that closing schools is a really difficult decision. What Alberta did in December, which I thought was very smart, was actually to close the schools for the older children, the junior and senior high schools. So you're not causing a child care crisis. You're not causing people to drop out of the workplace. You're not having this sort of biased thing that it's a very gendered thing that one parent can stay home, and in people's minds, it's always the mother. But closing the high schools helped stop a lot of the transmission among teenagers and young adults. So those are the sorts of things that I think we really need to think about.
Right. Okay. Both of you, first of all, I think this is an urgent issue. And I've just got the mayor of Brampton, Patrick Brown, Bonnie Crombie, has just tweeted out this, and maybe this is going to align with things that you're talking about. He says, don't close elementary schools, vaccinate educators, close Amazon, those plants, we've had spreads there, close food processing plants, close busy big box stores, close crowded factories. If our supply chain can't handle it, then vaccinate essential workers. The same old approach isn't working. Reaction, Mayor Crombie.
Yeah, we know Mayor Brown and I are in sync on these issues. We both agree. We've had the discussion a little earlier. You know that Dr. Lowe characterized this as most menacing wave yet, and it is because of the rise of the variants that are 2.5 times as transmissible. And equally important is the profile of the individual that's going into the hospital, which is largely younger. We're seeing 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds. The average age now is 62. In the first wave, it was 74 plus. So they are going in sicker, the symptoms are more severe, and they end up staying longer. So this is this just tells you this is a different virus we're dealing with now. And I think over 50 to 60% of all new cases are these new variants of concern. So yes, we have to do things differently. Now, to break the chains of transmission, Dr. Lowe has suggested remote learning for our youth in schools. That's one part of it. But Mayor Brown and I are in sync. You know, we've been in lockdown so long, nothing has been open, yet our rates of transmission have increased, case numbers have increased. So where is that occurring? In essential work, places. So let's look at those places, whether they are the Amazons of the world or manufacturing or food warehousing or warehouse distribution. Let's look there, the Amazons and the Canada Post that are essential. Why aren't we vaccinating those people? And I know largely it was because the supply of vaccine wasn't coming in, but we know it's come in now. So I don't, no disrespect, we have an age framework. That's terrific. But now that the vaccine is here, let's target those areas that are critical. They are the source of the transmission. Let's target the source of the transmission. Maybe they're in the big box stores. Maybe they should have closed. Right. Maybe we should have closed those non-essential aisles, as you and I had talked about before, and, you know, reduce the size and scale and scope of those stores. They're shipping out record profits, but that's besides the point. But in our, where our most vulnerable, our essential workers are working, many of them without sick pay benefits, may I add, let's get those people vaccinated.
Okay, and just last word to you, Nancy, Mayor of Calgary. Do you agree with that? Should we be vaccinating teachers? Should we be vaccinating people who are working in grocery stores? People who are working in factories? Like Bonnie Crombie says, you know, don't put
transit
fire
drivers.
On the,
don't forget
the neighborhood that's not on fire, or transit drivers. Put it on the places where maybe this is spreading. What's your take on that, Mayor?
So I live in a neighborhood here in Northeast Calgary, which had at one time the highest rates of infection of any country in the world. And, you know, our premier got in a little bit of trouble because he implied that it was because South Asian people are too hospitable. The real answer is because everyone in my neighborhood works in frontline services. And so I do believe that the age-based framework for vaccination served us well to get the old people vaccinated. And I'm taking my mom for her second shot tomorrow. She's 80. I'm very excited about it. But I think now that we have protected the really vulnerable older people, I absolutely think it's time to move to people at risk. Frontline workers, you know, for example, here in Alberta, in the next phase, we're going to do police officers, but not firefighters who perform emergency medical response every day. Ridiculous. And so let's get to the teachers, the transit drivers, the folks who have to go to work every day and be exposed to people, and get through those as quickly as we can, even using AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson one dose when it comes, in order to get as much of that population inoculated and then return to our age-based age-based vaccination. I'd very much advocate for that.
Yeah, you're hearing this from mayor after mayor. Get away from the age-based now that we've protected long-term care homes. Mayor Crombie and Mayor Nenshi, we've taken a lot of your time. I appreciate it really very much. Take care of your citizens and yourselves. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much. And remember, everybody, keep the discipline and stay safe.
And get vaccinated. Don't forget.
Yeah, well, if we can get the vaccination, we all would. We want to hear from you. By the way, vaccine hesitancy is obviously a very big thing. We got to stop that as well. Reach out to us through social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, email. Lots to talk about. We want to hear from you. Do you agree with what the mayor's just said? Coming up, vaccine priorities. Let's continue this conversation. Should teachers, should other essential workers be getting the jab first? Do we need to switch to an essential workers, not an age base? Jerry Dias, the national president of Unifor, and Dr. Ahmed Ari, a palliative care physician, will join us next. Stay with us.
If sick days time hadn't come, paid sick days time hadn't come before this, which I believe they had, and we said that as individual mayors and as groups of mayors, then the time has certainly come now. We're in the third wave. It
is one that is taking its time has come for sick paid sick leave. Time has come for what else? With the variants hitting younger people harder, with ICU beds across the country filling up, as you just heard before the break from the mayors of Mississauga and the mayor of Calgary, is it time to change the vaccination protocol to deal with the new reality? Moving away from an age-based protocol to an essential frontline workers, people like grocery store clerks, should they get the jab? What about teachers? Should they be a priority? Let's bring in Jerry Dias. He is the president of Unifor, the largest private sector union in the country. Jerry, first of all, happy Easter Monday to you and your loved ones. What's your sense, given the variants, given the surges, about people in factories, people in teachers, people working in grocery stores. Do we need to shift to put them on the vaccine priority list?
Absolutely. We're sending workers to slaughter. Let's be straightforward and call it what it is. We're saying to the workers, you're essential. We need you. We're depending on you. We're depending on you to show up every day. So we're moving forward on the healthcare workers. But grocery store workers, every single day, showing up for work, transit drivers, teachers, police, fire, I can walk through the list. If we're sending them to work each and every day, then look, we better protect them. And I think that's fair. My father's 91 years old, Evan. He's had his shots, and I'm happy about that. But is he exposed? No. Is he spending his time in the house? Yes. So look, we need to control this. We need to find a way to get our hands around this. And the only way we're going to do it is we're going to have to go to the people who are the most vulnerable and the most vulnerable at spreading. That's why I think we need to take it a step farther. I think we need to go to the workplaces. I think we need to go to the workplaces and start to vaccine workers that are in close contact with each other each and every day. We have to be more aggressive than we are. And frankly, I think governments are failing dramatically in this regard.
Okay, hang on, Jerry. I want to bring in Dr. Amit Arya, the palliative care physician who's joining us now. Doc, thanks for your frontline work. Most provinces have kept schools open during the third wave. There's lots of talk about moving away from the age-based protocols because we've now protected people like, you know, my parents or Jerry's parents, people who are in long-term care homes. They've got the vaccine. Given the third wave, given where ICUs, the age range is falling, should teachers and other frontline workers, as Jerry Dias is talking about, should we move to a protocol where they are vaccinated first now?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I can share with you working on the front lines of COVID-19 through this pandemic and working in Peel Region in Ontario, where so many essential workers live and work. I mean, really, everyone that I'm seeing coming into the hospital who's suffering and dying from COVID-19 is someone who's an essential worker or their family member. And in my eyes, this is all preventable suffering. We have these vaccines in the freezers, and we need to get them into the right arms, and we need to have paid sick days, but this is all preventable, and it should not be happening.
Okay, so you would make the shift right now? Because I just want to remind people, and Doc, you can weigh in on this. This week, Canada's going to get 2.2 million doses of the vaccine, 1 million of Pfizer, over 800,000 of Moderna, 316,000 of AstraZeneca from the COVAX facility. You think we've got to take that amount of dose and prioritize these frontline workers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I can share with everyone who's watching that it was actually in the end of February where the Ontario government's own science advisory table said that, well, we know that it's not just age, but it's actually the postal code in which you live in. It's the neighborhood in which you live in. And the highest risk neighborhoods are those neighborhoods where you have more essential workers. I mean, there's recent data that shows that the growth rate of the variants is almost three times higher in the neighborhoods where essential workers live. So, I mean, if you have these fires that are raging in specific areas of the province, that's where you take the fire trucks. And that's how you get the pandemic under control quickly. And I wanted to add that, of course, vaccination is one part of this, where, you know, we need to make this a 24/7 operation, get speed and precision, get the vaccines in the right arms. But vaccination won't protect us today. What will protect us today is making sure that we have paid sick days, we have rapid testing, and we have N95 masks in these high-risk workplaces.
Yeah, Jerry Dias, weigh in on that, because you got the Toronto Mayor John Tory calling for the Ontario and the federal government to work together to implement paid sick days for essential workers. Your thought on that?
Well, there's no question it has to be. I mean, one of the first things that the Doug Ford government did was it repealed Bill 148, which included two sick days. So it's almost now as if, you know, admitting that they made a mistake is a harder pill to swallow than doing what's right. So there's a real lack of courage happening right now, because to send people to work when they are sick, without, look, people are going to go to work because they can't afford not to. I think the Peel study laid it all out, Evan. Over 8,000 people tested positive. 2,000 people continued to go to work with symptoms. 80 people went to work after they had the test was 100% positive. So why? Because of a lack of pay. We know today that about 58% of all workers have paid sick days from work. We know that workers $25,000 a year and less, there's only about 30% of them. So they continue to go to work because they have to make a decision about putting food on their plate. And I think the death of the 40-year-old woman the other day, and Dr. Warner, to his credit, is speaking so incredibly important about her. Her husband was told, there's not an outbreak on your shift. If you don't come to work, you're not going to get paid. He went to work. His wife has now passed away. His daughter is sick. No rhyme or reason for this. It takes courage. They have to do it now.
Jerry, it's that story is so tragic. Dr. Arya, I want to go back to you. The other factor here, I don't think we're paying nearly enough attention to, is why there is so much vaccine hesitancy. There are people who are actually allowed to get it, encouraged to get it, and you've got political leaders saying they're not coming. What is driving the vaccine hesitancy?
Well, I think there's several factors related to this, and I wanted to talk about paid sick days again. I mean, if you don't have time, paid time off to go and get the vaccine, and as Jerry has outlined, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, well, that's going to be framed as vaccine hesitant, when really it's not hesitancy. It's a barrier in the system that's preventing you from getting the vaccine. And I can share with you data that shows that 65% of essential workers actually have vaccine hesitancy, and I'm using that term in quotes because it's not real hesitancy, in my opinion. It's a barrier. But 65% of essential workers are not going to go and get this vaccine because they're worried about, you know, losing money and losing their salary. And this would improve by 30% if we had paid sick days. So that's number one. I'm also seeing a lot of focus on these mass vaccine clinics, and they really favor people who speak English, you know, who have internet and a phone and have time off work to go and book an appointment or someone to take them. And really, that can't be happening in these sort of high-risk neighborhoods. I absolutely agree with what Jerry was saying, where we need to get the vaccine to these high-risk neighborhoods, these high-risk postal codes, get it into the workplaces, the factories, distribution, you know, the distribution centers. And that's one way that we're going to sort of at least have some light at the end of the tunnel at this point in time in the third wave, when we have ICU admissions hitting records day after day.
Yeah, the persuasive arguments. Dr. Arya, palliative care physician, I really appreciate you joining us. Jerry Dias, president of Unifor, also really good to have your perspective on this. Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, day six of the Chauvin trial. Check this out.
Approximately 10 to 15% decrease in survival for every minute that CPR is not administered.
Dramatic developments at the trial. The chief of police of Minneapolis goes against Chauvin's defense. We'll talk about that with CTV News Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbon. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. In the trial of Derek Chauvin, the ex-police officer charged with last year's death of George Floyd, the Minneapolis police chief who fired Chauvin took the stand. It was a dramatic moment as Chief Madaria Arredondo said he did not believe Chauvin followed police policy and that his actions were not a reasonable use of force, which directly contradicts Chauvin's defense. I want you to look at this clip.
Once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly, when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, it is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Chief Arredondo's testimony, very sharp there. Now, Floyd's death, of course, sparked protests around the world after footage was released of Chauvin kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. Floyd literally begging for his life, saying, I cannot breathe, I cannot breathe. So what happened today at the trial, and what happens as it moves into the second week? To talk more about this, CTV's Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbon joins us. She's been following it closely on an Easter Monday. Joy, I hope you and your loved ones are well. Talk about how dramatic it was. We just showed that clip of the Minneapolis police chief. Why was that so critical?
because this is one of the most high-profile witnesses. It's very unusual for a police chief to testify against a former officer, let alone an officer. I don't believe it's ever happened in this country before. So he was key. Listening to the testimony, Chief Arredondo, he went over police tactics, neck restraints, the severity of a crime. And remember, George Floyd was accused of passing a suspected phony $20 bill. And he said it did not rise to use such excessive force. Very strong words from him. And remember, too, after Arredondo fired Chauvin and three other officers, after he viewed all the video, spoke to witnesses, he said that he believed what happened to George Floyd was murder.
Yeah, it was quite something to see that. And of course, this notion that there's some kind of thin blue line clearly cracked on the stand there. The other person I thought, Joy, was interesting on the stand is the prosecution put the doctor who declared Floyd's death on the stand. What was the purpose of that?
Well, he was basically there to refute the defense's claim that somehow excessive drug use, an untreated heart condition, other health ailments killed Floyd, and not the excessive force, the 9 minutes and 29 seconds kneeling on Floyd's neck. He was asked, what do you think the likely cause was? And remember, too, he's trying to save George Floyd's life. There's no pulse, no heart rhythm, nothing. And he said the most likely cause was a lack of oxygen, which in layman's terms is asphyxia.
Yeah, that was. So now what, Joy? Who are we going to hear in the days to come as we get into the second week of this?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Because of all the security, because, you know, this has been so high profile of a trial, I mean, not since Rodney King and when he was beaten by police officers has there been such a landmark trial. They're keeping it very close to their chest, but expect more medical experts. Expect the defense to try and call their medical experts to try and say, look, you know, someone with fentanyl in their system, someone who's, you know, had a lifelong struggle with addiction. Expect those kinds of people to come forward. Certainly last week was gripping emotional testimony from bystanders, from witnesses, from Floyd's girlfriend who told us more about the man. And it has been gripping, and it's been carried live on TV here in America. So this is going to be a crucial trial that everybody is watching.
Yeah, you're right. The public side of it, which is so critical to the politics, which plays into such a deep political vein in the United States, that's playing out and that's being received, obviously. And it's been electrifying to see that. CTV's Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbon, always good to have you on the program, Joy. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Evan.
All right. Coming up on our program. Necessary new restrictions are harsher new restrictions the only option to keep the variants at bay? And should Canada follow the UK and have twice a week rapid testing to help in some kind of recovery when we get through the worst of this? We're going to put that to Dr. Abdu Sharkawi. Do we even have the tests? Press Gallery is next. Welcome back to the program. So Ontario hit a record high number of patients in ICUs with COVID-19 related illness. This is all driven by the variant. So that race that we've talked about for so long between the variants and the vaccines is clearly being won right now by the variants, even as 2.2 million vaccines are coming into the country this week. 1 million Pfizer, over 800 Moderna, over 316,000 AstraZeneca. Today, though, that province logged nearly 3,000 new infections of COVID-19. That was just a few days after Ontario implemented its emergency break to curb the spread of the variants. But if you look at Alberta, if you look at BC, if you look at Quebec, if you look at Ontario, are any of these restrictions enough to keep the variants at bay? Do tighter restrictions become necessary? Are protocols needing to change as to who is getting vaccinated? And what about the next phase? Is rapid testing the key to any recovery? Today, the UK thinks so. They're going to have 2 rapid tests a week for everybody in the recovery. Should Canada follow suit? Press Gallery is here to talk about that. Ian Bailey is a reporter with the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau. He writes the Globe's daily politics briefing. I don't know if he's even in Ottawa yet, but if he is, welcome aboard. We've got Emily Nicolau, that superb columnist with Le Devoir and the Montreal Gazette, and our friend Dr. Abdi Sharkawi, who does extraordinary frontline work and is CTV's infectious disease specialist. Great to have all of you here. Doc, man, you and I spoke even earlier today. I'm going to give you a bit of a grab bag. The change of protocol, moving from age-based vaccination to frontline workers, and then do we need harsher restrictions in, you know, teachers? Do they either need to be vaccinated or should there be a stay-at-home order? I mean, you're on the front lines in your province. What do you think?
I think it's become abundantly clear that our definition of what is essential needs to be broadened, and our definition of what is non-essential needs to be restricted further or narrowed, because at this point in time, there are simply far too many discretionary decisions being made that are not very wise. And you look at scenes from Yorkdale Mall here in Ontario yesterday with throngs and throngs of people indoors. And you try and contrast that and reconcile it with small businesses that have had to shut their doors and patios that are closed, and you try and make sense of this, and you can't. And we are seeing teachers get sick, and we are seeing our ICUs flooded with young essential workers. Clearly, what we're doing right now is not working. The message is not clear enough. The behavior is not following through in a safe enough way. And the variants are spreading rapidly as a result of both of these situations. So yes, we do have to earmark teachers, school staff, transit workers, everyone who has no role other than having to go to work, people who have no choice but to go to work and face the public, they need to be the targets of our vaccine efforts right now. It can't simply be age-based, and we've got to do that as soon as possible, and we have to limit anything that's non-essential. Malls, frankly, should not be open at this point in time. Any business that's non-essential should not be open. Anything that allows people to congregate in close quarters should not be allowed to open at this point in time. It's simply not tenable right now with what we're seeing in our hospitals.
So, Doc, you're giving us a picture of where you're working. Let me go west. Ian, our case is spiking in British Columbia. What's the sense there in terms of the amount of restrictions that might be needed and maybe about who needs to get the vaccination first?
Well, Evan, you spoke earlier in the show about a whole new pandemic, and it feels like a whole new pandemic out here. We are seeing 1,000 a day case counts, which may not sound like a lot given what some of the other provinces are facing, but out here is unthinkable. It's like something many months ago that would have been unthinkable, but this is the third wave that was promised. The restrictions here, there are new restrictions. There's a circuit breaker underway. There's limits on restaurants. Whistler Blackcomb, the big ski resort north of Vancouver, is essentially closed because of the spread of the Brazilian variant out there. But the health authorities are sticking to their guns, basically. Some emergency workers and others have been vaccinated out of order. But the backbone of vaccination is the age-based sort of order of things, and that's basically what they're doing out here, and just sort of hoping to vaccinate their way and convince people to a success in this thing, and of course keep people sticking to the rules out here.
Emily, give me the perspective in Quebec. I mean, I keep hearing this, but you know, the new variants it seems like they're coming so quickly, they're always beating the restrictions, and then we're playing catch up. Well, how are they doing it in Quebec?
Yeah, the thing is, it's not just about the restrictions, and I get that it's really, tempting for governments to put the responsibility of fighting the pandemic on individuals, but it's really more complicated than that. We've seen in Quebec, there's actually been a lot of debate in the National Assembly in the last couple of days around the responsibility of the Minister of Education when it comes to making sure that the air quality in schools is safe. And so we know that the virus is airborne. And so if a year into this pandemic, we haven't fixed our air quality, of course, people are getting sick. And then if we have to close our schools down, then it's the kids that pay the price for something that is not up to individual behavior. We're seeing the same thing in Ontario. People have been advocating for paid sick leaves, and we know that if there's an outbreak going on in a warehouse and that the employer does not shut down the warehouse and that people are forced to go to work because they don't have paid sick leave, it's an issue as well that has nothing to do with restriction. And so at least if the government got its own, you know, program straight, it would be a great deal of improvement rather than only blaming the individuals for what's going on right now.
You know, you've said it right. You know, this idea that the leadership, it's just on people. There are choices that have to be made. Doc, just because I want to move to something, I know it's hard to think of anything in the future, but the United Kingdom today, Boris Johnson saying, look, in order to, once you get through this, the UK is going to have, there'll be rapid testing available twice a week to every single person, free of charge in England, to try to keep this in abeyance in some way. Is that something that Canada should seriously consider? I don't even know if we have those, that amount of tests, and I don't even know how effective they are, but as a doctor, what's your view on that?
On paper, that looks good. I think in reality, I'm not so sure it's the most cost-effective way to do things. And we certainly don't have that many rapid tests in Canada anyways. I think rapid tests do have a very important role, however, particularly in certain settings, like schools, like congregative work environments, where they can provide an additional layer of screening for people who may have difficulty getting to a clinic or some form of COVID testing facility to get a PCR test done. Now, bear in mind, these tests do have limitations. They're not very sensitive, especially if you don't have symptoms. So for all the people out there who are pre-symptomatic or haven't already started to get sick, they're not going to pick up as positive. They're also only about 70% positive overall. So you can't use them by themselves to determine if you've got COVID or not, but certainly an additional useful screening tool, again, in places like schools and factories and congregative work settings, I think absolutely it's something that we need to look at and explore and continue to consider as a big part of recovering through this pandemic. We can't get through it just with the vaccines alone.
Yeah, masks, social distancing, restrictions, vaccines, rapid tests. We need an arsenal. Dr. Sharkawi, great to have you on the program. Emily and Ian, please stick around because we've got some exclusive new polling done. Look, we've got a budget coming in 2 weeks, the first federal budget in 2 years. What is on the ballot box issue? Yes, the pandemic. Yes, the recovery. But what else? Would its price on carbon impact your vote? We've got the pollster Nick Nanos with some really interesting new data. Stick around. We'll share it with you in a minute. Welcome back to the program. So we're 2 weeks from a federal budget, and of course the pandemic is probably going to be one of the key ballot box questions. But what else might be on affecting your vote if there was a spring election? Well, we've got exclusive new polling data from Nanos Research, just done for PowerPlay, that shows some interesting issues. For example, Canadians are more likely to vote for a party that supports a price on carbon than a party that opposes it. I want to show you this. Overall, about 36% of Canadians surveyed would vote for a candidate whose party backs a price on carbon. 24% of respondents wouldn't support it, while another 32% said carbon pricing was not an issue that would affect their vote at all. Now, remember, this poll comes just weeks after the Supreme Court gave the federal government the green light to impose some kind of minimum standard on carbon pricing. And, of course, there was this resolution that the Conservatives couldn't pass, that climate change is real at their convention. So this is an issue. So what does it mean going forward as all the parties are moving towards some kind of election footing? The Conservatives had their policy convention a couple weeks ago. You've got the Liberals and the NDP having theirs this week. Everybody's getting ready. So let's bring back the press panel to the press gallery to dig into that. Ian Bailey, the Globe and Mail's, he's still in Vancouver, but he's going to join the Ottawa Bureau soon enough. I hope he likes that. Emily Nicola from Le Devoir and The Gazette. And our pollster is our friend Nick Nanos from Nanos Research. Nick, great to have you here, and happy Easter Monday to you. Nick, let me just start with you. What does this, look, I guess if there's an election, the ballot box question is all going to be the pandemic, but price on carbon is very politicized. What does this data that you found tell you?
Well, what it tells us is that it's more likely to be a vote draw than to be a drag for those parties that are in favor of a price on carbon. But, you know, Evan, the killer numbers are the ones beneath the regional variations. If you're in the province, if you happen to be a Canadian that lives in the province of British Columbia, your 43% say that they will vote in favor of a party that supports a carbon tax. That's bad news for the Conservatives in British Columbia. And, you know, the other thing is, when we look at the prairies, they're most likely to vote against a party that has a price on carbon. But the thing is they're already voting Conservative. So this particular issue is more efficient for the Liberals based on the distribution of views because of Canadians outside of the prairies more likely to favor a party that supports a price on carbon.
Yeah, it's interesting, Emily, when you look at that, Conservatives need to grow in a couple of areas. They just didn't have, as Nick said, an efficient vote. They got the most votes in the last election, but they are concentrated in Alberta and Saskatchewan. They need to grow in Quebec. They need to grow in the suburbs of Ontario. They need to grow in the lower mainland, BC. Is the environmental issue and a price on carbon going to be a help or a hindrance to them?
In those regions that you've just named, Quebec and BC, I mean, definitely it's a hindrance, especially with the vote that they've had at their national convention against recognizing climate change as a real issue. This is something that the opposition parties, the Liberals, the NDP, will not let fly. I mean, this is very good material for either attack ads or debates, questions. And so linking the Conservatives to being anti-environment is definitely something that other parties will try to look to do. And it will be hard, if you're trying to make a complex response that is not necessarily easy to digest, it's going to be hard for them to answer those attacks, if that is indeed a valid question or an important issue in this election, rather than just looking at the pandemic.
Yeah, and you know, I think we'll find out how important it will be when the Liberals have their budget in 2 weeks, but also at the policy conventions for the NDP and the Liberals. Are they going to put climate at the forefront, or even if they want to, is it all about the pandemic?
Well, going back to the carbon tax, I mean, British Columbia settled this issue to a degree in 2009 election. The Conservatives have promised a climate change plan, and one will be coming, without a carbon tax. This certainly raises the bar for what the Conservatives have to put on offer for voters in the Lower Mainland, a competitive area of the country, those voters who are going to vote with the environment. Maybe the Conservatives will come up with something, you know, very good, maybe not, but it certainly made the challenge very difficult for them ahead. And obviously, two party conventions this week, the Liberals, the New Democrats, and I expect, obviously, the environment will be a part of both of those conventions and touting their environmental credentials. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and Nick, you pulled, just speaking about that, not only the environment, Nick also did a poll question for us. What is more important to you as a general public policy objective, running a budget deficit to invest in programs for Canadians or balancing the budget to ease the tax burden? And I'm intrigued because this will be calibrated, Nick, through what they want to spend money on. What did you find here?
Yeah, actually, Evan, Canadians are absolutely deadlocked on this. 46% say they want they're good with a deficit to invest in Canadians. 46% are looking to kind of balance the budget in order to kind of control things for the future. The key thing is that Canadians are cross-pressured. They know that they need stimulus right now. They need to get through the pandemic. Canadian enterprises need support. But at the same time, they're worried about the bill. And, you know, that's why this federal budget is going to be critical. You know, I don't think there's a lot of debate on the need for stimulus. There's a general agreement among all the parties that there needs to be some sort of stimulus and help to Canadians. But the big question is, what's going to happen after stimulus? What is the strategy to get back to some sort of normal fiscal situation where we're not running massive deficits, and how long will we have to wait? You know, the other thing, Evan, when we look at the tracking on this is that, you know, the balanced budgets actually had the upper hand back in March 2019. It's dropped 5 points to be a dead heat. So, you know, people have moved away from a balanced budget to running deficits right now. But I think it's going to be one of the key dividing points, and Canadians are completely divided on this.
Yeah, Emily, what do you make of that? Because balanced budgets, you just wonder if that's a pre-pandemic priority, and a post-pandemic priority, it's not. Nick's saying it's still pretty darn close.
Yeah, I remember if I remember correctly, the way the question is phrased, that people are worried that they don't want to run a deficit that's going to then increase their taxes or the taxes of Canadians in general. And so I think that if you put it like that, then it, of course, a lot of people would be worried about their specific taxes raising. So I guess for me, a key communication point is that if you're planning to either go back to balancing the budget or just in general, just increase the revenue of the government to match the new spending, so the new social programs, then you need to get a little bit more specific about how is it that you're going to raise that money so that if people who are, you know, the working class or the middle class is worried about getting their taxes raised, then you need to make sure that if that's not your plan, then you need to have another plan and you need to make sure that people know, you know, how do you plan to address this issue in the future.
Yeah, okay, I got a minute and a half. I just want to get this to Ian because you're in Vancouver. Nick also pulled a story about a prisoner swap, Chinese national Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive who's in that her mansion in Vancouver on the extradition charges. Would most Canadians support a swap for her and for the two Michaels, Kovrig and Spavor? And it's really interesting, nearly 6 in 10 Canadians support or somewhat support a prisoner swap. Ian, the Prime Minister's ruled out this. What do you make of the fact that Canadians just want to swap the two and end this thing?
Well, you know, the Canadians and the Prime Minister may be on different pages here. As you said, the current Prime Minister is in charge. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, he's ruled this out. This is not happening. This case is going through the routine procedure. So it seems almost like a draw. I cannot see this government right now shifting to some kind of swap unless something changed that I can't imagine on this file. So it seems totally like a draw. It seems like this is going through the courts in BC to the next stage.
Yeah, interesting to see Canadians shift. And as Nick found, older Canadians are more likely to support this than younger Canadians. All right, that's interesting. I got to leave it there, though. Emily Nicola, Ian Bailey, and Nick Nanos. And Nick will post all the results of your great polling, obviously, on the CTV website. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks so much for watching. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones only if it's safe. I'll see you tomorrow.